This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be talking with a couple of authors in the next hour. You should know, though, that this program is not going out over the air on KVMR. It's an online-only version. It will be archived with all of the other programs, but because we don't have enough days in the month, since Booktown alternates with Zen Tech, and there are a lot of authors I would like to interview and books I would like to discuss, this one will be archived, as I said, with all the other ones. You can go to booktown.blogspot.com, or you can just go to the Booktown listing on the program schedule at kvmr.org, and you'll see this program listed with all the others. In the next hour, I'll be talking with Eric Blem, author of The Last Season, the story of the disappearance of backcountry ranger Randy Morganson, who is a ranger at Sequoia Kings Camp National Park. He disappeared in July of 1996. I'll also be talking with the New Yorker's China correspondent, Peter Hessler, the author of a wonderful earlier book, Rivertown, 2 Years on the Yangtze. He has a brand new book called Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present. Let's start with Eric Blem. So who was Randy Morganson?
Well, Randy Morganson was a seasonal backcountry ranger at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, and he was, in 1996, the year of his disappearance, the most veteran backcountry ranger in that park, and probably one of the most veteran park rangers in the entire park service. He had dedicated almost 30 years of his life to the seasonal ranger position, and he was just an interesting character. He grew up in Yosemite National Park, where his father worked for the concessionaire of the park and Curry Company back in the 40s when he was hired. So Randy, from age 2 until up to his college years, lived in this amazing place. They called it the Granite Womb, Yosemite Valley, because it was kind of a protected place. It was a place where you don't lock your doors, and the keys for your vehicle are left on top of the sun visor, and things like that. And so he grew up in this environment that kind of nurtured his love and awe and reverence for the wilderness.
And I guess he couldn't get away from it. He tried going to college, and it just didn't take, so he went to the Peace Corps and then into the Himalayas. There seems to be nothing he loved more than mountains.
Absolutely. He said he once said that nothing, no class he could ever take, no teacher, no professor could ever teach him more than the mountains have taught him in his life.
What's the difference between a backcountry ranger and other rangers?
Well, first of all, just from the name, they do work far and away from civilization. They're actually helicoptered, or they have their supplies brought into their remote duty stations via mule train or like I said, helicopter. And so they are self-sufficient. They work alone. They generally, they'll have sometimes guests, like their wives, if they're married, or girlfriends might stay a few days with them out of each season. But they, for the most part, are alone patrolling the most rugged parts of our national parks, oftentimes off-trail. And they're just there as, they wear many hats. They're a park medic. They're search and rescue specialists. They're naturalists. They're geologists. They're interpreters that just are really there for the park visitors that do venture off the beaten path. And when, you know, tragedy strikes or some unforeseen event, you know, puts a park visitor in peril, you know, these are the guys and men and women now that are there to rescue, if not, you know, on occasion on the bad days, recover bodies. And, you know, other times they'll do things just like a regular campground ranger would do, like pick up trash left behind by careless, you know, visitors and backpackers. That's really, they're kind of a jack of all trades. So the big thing is they have to be self-starters. They have to be very comfortable alone in the wilderness. But at the same time, they have to be very comfortable with people because at the end of the day, they're still a steward and a host.
And I guess they get very little compensation and very little recognition.
Yeah. I mean, a backcountry ranger, a seasonal backcountry ranger in the National Park Service, first of all, they're hired and fired every year. There is no guarantee, there is no seniority that they'll be hired the following year. There is no pension, there's no retirement. And they even pay for their own training, for EMT training and law enforcement training. They're law enforcement officers, and it all comes out of their own pocket. So it's really, they do it, they say rangers, all rangers actually say that they're paid in sunsets because nobody's getting paid, no one's doing it for the money, really. There's not a lot of money involved, and they just do it really for the experience and for their love of the land.
And Randy Morganson did this for 28 years?
He did it for 28 years as a backcountry ranger in Sequoia and Kings Canyon, but he also was a winter ranger. He spent a full winter in Tuolumne Meadow in Yosemite, and he was a Nordic ski ranger in Badger Pass back in the era when they wore, you know, wool knickers and black sweaters in the Park Service. So he really has been at it for a long time. He began his career the year after the passing of the Wilderness Act. It was 1964, the Wilderness Act was passed, and his first year was 1965. And then just after a three-year sabbatical in the Peace Corps in the Himalayas, he spent the rest of his days wandering around the mountains in California, Sierra Nevada, and that was really, really his love.
More even than his marriage, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that type of job is difficult in all relationships, and it's kind of like a military existence, really. They're stationed where they don't really have the daily contact or even weekly or, in his case, monthly contact. He's back in the backcountry for 4 months of the year, and the only way that he has visits is if his wife was willing to hike in and see him, which she did. But at the same time, during the time of his disappearance, there was a few difficult parts, things going on in his life. His mother had passed away recently, a long illness that he sat with her through, and he was just kind of, some of his friends just called it the classic midlife crisis. He had an affair with a fellow ranger, a female ranger, and she actually was involved in the actual eventual search and rescue operation, and so you can imagine the emotional turmoil that was going on among the rangers at the time. And as far as Randy's wife goes, at first she thought that he was just trying to kind of worry her, you know, that he didn't check in after 4 days on the radio, and she knew that she'd be the first person that they'd check with. And she had sent him into the backcountry that year with divorce papers. She'd had enough. And despite his begging her to come with him that season and to spend the season in the high country, she didn't. And again, that season, the season that he took off on patrol and was never seen again.
I guess for the first 26 or 27 years back there, he became considered maybe the ablest and the wisest of the backcountry rangers.
Yeah, he was really, I mean, some of the terms that people told me was he was the wise man of the woods, the sage, or the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the high country. He really had an innate sense for the wilderness and how it pulls at a person. When someone went missing in the park in the backcountry, he was the first person they'd call, and he also was widely regarded as one of the park's most fanatical environmentalists. He took great offense to people who camped in his meadows or started fires in his meadows and scarred the land, and he did his best to teach people about these. But there are times when he would blow up a little, usually in his journals, and that was what was really neat for me. I was able to go back through his journals and his diaries and kind of paint the portrait of this man or his spirit in his absence of really what he was all about in the backcountry. And again,
when this search and rescue operation began, one of the rangers said that they were the five rangers that were first called to the Bench Lake duty station in Kings Canyon, said they were the unusual suspects, because the usual suspects would have included Randy, and so they called it an ominous hole in their ranks when he wasn't there. They were searching for one of their own, and that really made it difficult.
And he was the one who had actually trained many of them and inspired many of them.
He definitely inspired many of them. They have their own seasonal yearly training, and as far as some of the younger rangers, they definitely looked up to Randy, if not for his training in search and rescue, but also just in his ethics in wilderness travel and leave no trace camping. And he had actually once told one of his fellow rangers, "I'd like to hike the entire 211-mile John Muir Trail and not leave a single footprint." And he was fully capable of doing that. And so you can imagine someone who takes that sort of ethic while camping and hiking in the high country, how difficult it would be to strike out and search for a person like this.
And especially since in the last year or two before his disappearance, I guess he had begun to change.
Yeah, he was, like I said before, he was kind of at a rough point in his life. And, for instance, he grew up and his father was a naturalist in Yosemite, and he was mentored by Ansel Adams, I didn't mention earlier, the photographer. He used to carry around Ansel Adams' tripod, and Ansel Adams actually gave him his first camera, a box camera. Wallace Stegner, the famous author, and shortly after he had won the Pulitzer Prize for Angle of Repose for fiction, he met up with Randy and started to critique some of Randy's work and as a writer. And Randy really had this love that he tried to convey of the wilderness on paper, on film, and at the end of the day, before he disappeared, one of his fellow rangers was talking to him and mentioned how it was going to be a wet year and a great year in the high country for flowers, and Randy was just like a walking encyclopedia when it came to flowers. He turned around and said, "You know, I don't find much joy in the flowers anymore," and this guy said it really chilled him to the core, because he had never known Randy to be that blasé about flowers. The flowers were his thing. And so that was kind of a hint towards the mindset that he had when he went into the backcountry that season.
I guess he'd been there about a month, a little over a month, and then he left a note that he was going to make his rounds, and within 3 or 4 days, nobody had heard from him.
Yeah, he left a note saying he'd be on patrol for 3 or 4 days. He actually dated it June, when it was really July when he took off. On that date was, I believe, July 21st when he went on patrol. And he wrote June 21st. So that was another little hint that people thought it could have been an indication of his mindset. But a lot of people just said, "Hey, that happens. You know, we all write sometimes June when we mean July." But yeah, he took off and on this patrol. And when he didn't check in, they had a thing called Morning Roundup, where they check in on the backcountry rangers one at a time from park headquarters. And after the first day, generally, they're noted as out of contact, and then they would continue this. And after 2 days, they're supposed to begin a search. Well, some of the protocol they had in place didn't quite work out, and they actually ended up starting the search about 24 hours after they should have. And so when they finally actually began the search, he'd been out there for 4 days. And so you can imagine in the Sierra, which, you know, being in the area where your listeners are, you know, it's rugged terrain, and being alone, any of a number of things could happen to a person. And he luckily was versed with survival skills probably better than anybody, and so if anybody could hold on, if he had met with like a rock slide or a landslide, perhaps was pinned by a boulder, perhaps he had a heart attack or some sort of a medical emergency, when they finally started the search, 4 days had passed, and you know, that made it a very frantic search. I think they called it a desperate search in some cases, just because they were thinking that, again, that Randy Morganson was perhaps injured, perhaps near death somewhere in the mountains. And that's really when the book begins, when we kind of reconstruct the whole search and rescue operation and how you go about searching for a lost or just someone missing in wilderness. And the area of the search was 80 square miles, most all of it above 9,000 feet. So it was rugged, it was high, it was dangerous, and afternoon thunder and lightning storms that time of the year, a lot going on.
And there was still snow on the ground in places, even at the end of July, and it could get very cold, and radio contact was very poor.
Yeah, absolutely. The radios in Sequoia Kings Canyon, there's a lot of dead zones. I mean, just by the nature of the terrain, there's these deep valleys and high mountains, and there's radio repeaters. But in any event, there's shadows where there is no radio contact. And Randy actually had many times complained about the park's radio system. You know, there was the safety net of checking in on them. And just the season before, he was actually incommunicado for 8 days, and he had wrote really kind of sarcastically, you know, there's a protocol, where's my safety net? And at the end of the season, he wrote in his end of the season report, just probably some of the last words he wrote the season before he disappeared was, radio communication was poor again this year. Everybody knows. We hope it's better next year.
So once the search began, I guess it was quickly became the biggest search ever in Sequoia Kings Canyon.
Yeah, one of the most, I mean, sometimes when they're closer to the road, there might be more people, but remember, just because of the nature of the terrain, they wanted quality, not quantity, in their searchers. So they had, but they used everything from the military. They had an infrared, kind of a heat-seeking helicopter that flew at night. They had multiple dog teams. And, you know, soon enough, there was other, as they started looking into the potential criminal investigation, and, you know, this is a law enforcement officer that's missing. And there are people that, you know, sometimes there are run-ins in the backcountry. So there was all these different theories that popped up as they began this search as well.
And because of his state of mind and because of the impending divorce, there was fear that he might have just either decided to disappear or to kill himself.
Yeah, he had hinted. Well, it was interesting. He left these sort of breadcrumbs almost that kind of left hints towards possible things that he might have done. He had told one ranger that, the sky is the limit. I have all this freedom in my life now. And he talked about maybe taking off to start a new life elsewhere, you know, not necessarily disappear off the map like he did in this case, but these were the things that he alluded to. He'd also told another ranger friend that he had actually had suicidal thoughts, and he'd once actually told people, the least I owe these mountains is a body. You can't get any more, chilling premonition than that. He also had a couple run-ins with park visitors just the season before, enough so that he wrote about them vividly in his journals, and I talk about those incidents as well. So there, you know, there's a lot going on. He was reading a book at the very end, and the very last book he was reading was the story of Everett Roos, who was an adventurer back in the 30s, a young man who disappeared in the Escalante Wilderness, the Canyonlands in Utah. And Everett Roos wrote in the book, his last book, one of his last letters, a really interesting line that I have in the book, and it's, I'm going to paraphrase here, I think if I have it right, but he said, I'll go on one last wilderness trip to a place I have known and loved. I will not return. And it's just interesting that Randy was reading that book at the very end, and he had let people know that he was reading that book. So again, there's this mystery kind of steamrolling through the whole search and rescue process.
I guess the other two books that were significant in that last year were William Leistheat Moon's Blue Highways and Margaret Craven's I Heard the Owl Call My Name.
Absolutely, and I mean, again, you know, Randy always said that the wilderness, if you listen closely enough and if you're quiet, there are messages to be heard, and Margaret Craven's book basically, in a nutshell, talks of a man who learned that by natives up in a native tribe in, I think, B.C., British Columbia, said that when it's time for your death or when your death is approaching, that you'll hear the owl call your name. And he had given that as a parting gift to his wife after she'd served him with divorce papers. He'd also been reading William Leistheat Moon, who was a gentleman who had some marital problems, and he struck out on a 10,000 or 11,000-mile road trip across the least-traveled roads in America, just kind of dropped off the map for a while. And that was the second book that he was reading before he picked up the Everett Roos book. So here's some of those. These are some examples of these breadcrumbs that, you know, threw all these curveballs at the searchers, wondering if maybe he's not even in these mountains. Maybe he did take off. While others said there's no way Randy would do that to us, to his fellow, put them at risk in the search and rescue operation in those scenarios. The flying of the helicopter and landing in precarious landing zones. You know, he wouldn't have done that, but at the end of the day, everybody agreed that Randy, his mind wasn't in the right place. He was definitely in a funk at the end, and so nobody could be absolutely sure of anything.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, talking with Eric Blem, author of The Last Season, the story of the disappearance and search for Randy Morganson. So how did the search continue?
Well, the search continued for many, many days. In fact, it lasted much longer than they would normally search for, let's say, a civilian or just a person from the general public. And there were two reasons for this. Debbie Bird, who was the chief ranger at the time, explained it to me as she wanted to make sure that his colleagues, who were his friends and people who looked up to him, understood that they had really stopped at nothing to search for Randy, to do everything possible. Because the greatest fear in a search is to call a search off and then find out later that perhaps the person had died from an injury in the days after they were searched, especially finding out that they may have been very close to where, Randy might have been. And so they really wanted to make sure, and because Randy had such a background in survival and knew this wilderness better than anybody, they thought that he could last longer than anybody else. So it lasted many, many days. Normally a search and rescue operation would last maybe 6 or 7 days for the general public, and this lasted into 10 or 11 days, I believe, before they finally started to really scale it back. And then, they never stopped searching. Many of the rangers never stopped searching.
And even people like the retired, I can't remember his exact title. Yeah, Alden Nash continued looking on his own for months after that.
Yeah, for a great deal of time. I mean, we'll keep it kind of vague just so you can kind of, when you read the book, it kind of unfolds for the reader. But just suffice it to say that people did not want to let this mystery go unsolved. They wanted to really follow through. And eventually some clues were found that kind of gave, shed light on the subject. And without going into too much detail, I believe you said that there were some CCC trail crew members that are there in Nevada City area.
One of them, at least, was from Nevada County.
Nevada County. And basically, there's all sorts of people involved in this search, from, volunteers to trail crew members. And it's interesting that kind of these unlikely wilderness sleuths that were, had known of the disappearance did stumble upon some items in the backcountry that really kind of shed light on what happened to Randy Morganson. And the book, you will find out what does happen. It's not solely a mystery. And it's, again, without biting my tongue and putting my foot in my mouth and telling the audience what happens, you will find out.
Yeah, we'll leave that up to the readers. For listeners, what were the effects of Randy's life and his search? It obviously affected the searchers very much. And did it only affect them personally, or was there some change in the way the national parks have been run since then?
Well, as far as, Randy, again, he was concerned that the backcountry rangers weren't looked after as closely as they should have been, for their safety and things like this. And there was a critical incident, I think a board that reviewed the search and rescue operation and what had happened, and they definitely cracked down on the morning report, on the checking in of the rangers. And I can with a pretty high degree of certainty say that I don't think that any rangers were missing for more than 24 hours without someone seriously looking at what might have happened to them. They did start this one way too late. And again, time is life in the backcountry if you're injured. Other things, just the radio communication, looking into satellite phones and even personal locator beacons, things like that had come into play. And the National Park Service, like any government agency, is kind of a slow machine to move. The cogs kind of creak and they need oil. And, this was kind of one of the first things that really started getting those wheels oiled. And it took many years to do. For instance, they wanted to map the radio dead zones in the park. And I think it took more than 10 years before that finally was completed. So you can understand how, it's kind of the frustration for some of the rangers who were on the search and still working in that terrain and not really knowing which areas would carry a radio signal and which wouldn't. So a lot of things did change. As far as Randy himself, he was kind of like a Henry David Thoreau of the High Sierra. I mean, the High Sierra was his Walden Pond, and he was a writer, and a lot of his messages became known as the Gospel, or Morgansonia, as some people called it. And so that really spread to the different rangers. And he really was just an ordinary guy, the type of person who doesn't really come to life in anyone's life unless perhaps he saves your life. I mean, many people who he rescued in the backcountry wrote him these glowing letters of thanks. And this book is kind of a way to shed light on the on Randy Morganson through the lens of his life and his disappearance. I dedicated the book to the unsung heroes of the National Park Service because really they don't get a whole lot of credit for what they do, and they do just as much as you might consider, you know, a special forces military soldier, or you know, a SWAT team member, or a paramedic, or a fireman, or a police officer in the cities. These guys were doing it in the backcountry, in really rugged terrain, and living in third world conditions. And I just thought that the world needed to hear a full story of a person like this. And I think Randy Morganson was one of the best. And I think that this is a tribute to him and to people like him.
I guess you tried to meet him in 1992 while you were hiking the John Muir Trail, but he wasn't at his cabin.
Yeah, oddly enough, ironically, he was on patrol, and I had a note on his door. And it was pretty funny, as with my research, I knew I was going to learn a lot from this man when I started reading his diaries, and when his wife gave me access to all of his diaries and his journals and letters and things like that. And one thing that he called people that are just on a schedule and hiking traps like the John Muir Trail, just trying to make miles every day, he called them trail pounders. And I was definitely a trail pounder at the time. I wasn't willing to stick around for a few hours, even though I had been told that Randy Morganson was, he was this amazing sage, and someone had told me, Alden Nash had told me, that walking in the high country with him would be like walking with John Muir himself. And at that point in my life, I was a journalism major and outdoor recreation minor, and had been introduced to writers like John McPhee and Dale McKibben and John Muir. And there, he was one of my favorites. And still, I had to make my allotted miles for the day, and so I took off down the road. And so that would have been my one opportunity to meet him in person. Instead, I got to know the man and the spirit of a man through his journals, through hundreds of interviews with his friends and family and coworkers, and just piecing together the search and rescue operation when he went missing. Although nothing would have been nicer than to have met him in person and shaken his hand.
That was a conversation I recorded recently with Eric Blem, author of The Last Season, which was recently published by HarperCollins. The book is now in its fifth printing, and HarperCollins has made it one of its official submissions for this year's Pulitzer Prize. Also recently published by HarperCollins was Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present, by Peter Hessler, the New Yorker correspondent in China. I talked with him recently, beginning the conversation with a discussion of his first book, Rivertown, and of the time he spent there as a Peace Corps volunteer in the late 1990s. When you went to China 10 years ago, did you think you'd still be there now?
Certainly not. I mean, I was, you know, I went with a Peace Corps, and it's a 2-year commitment, and you know, which seems like a long time when you're 27 years old. And I thought 2 years would be, would be quite an achievement. I never expected that I'd be here this long. Although, you know, I did, from the moment I first went to China, I did realize that studying Chinese and gaining some familiarity with the country would be, you know, sort of a long-term skill. It's, you know, it's obviously an important part of the world, and it's very useful language to speak.
You also said in Rivertown that you were hoping to improve your writing, so I guess you went with the intention of producing a book?
No, not at all. I mean, I was, you know, actually a lot of, that's often been misinterpreted, that comment in Rivertown, because I didn't, you know, and I didn't even actually, when I wrote that book was when I was back in the States after the Peace Corps, and I wrote it without any contact with the publisher or editor or agent or anything like that. You know, I knew that as a young person who wants to write, one of the most important things is, first of all, to be inspired by your surroundings and by your material, and second, you need to have time. And I realized that for me personally, working for a newspaper or magazine probably wasn't going to provide either of those factors. And, you know, whereas living in the Peace Corps, I thought was probably a nice way to do that while I was also doing a job that I felt was useful and interesting.
So you returned to the U.S. in 1998, worked on the book, and then went back to China?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was at the very end of my Peace Corps time that I decided I wanted to write a book, and it was partly because a former professor of mine from college had gotten back in touch with me and had encouraged me to think about doing it. And so it was at the last few months when I was in schooling, I began working on thinking about structure and thinking about a book. And then when I returned to the States, I wrote it. I guess I was in the States for about 8 or 9 months, and then just made the decision to go back independently, which in some ways was a hard thing to do. I having lived in China in the Peace Corps, I knew that it could be rough, and to be on your own is also a little bit daunting, in a foreign country. I was moving to Beijing where I didn't know anybody. But at the same time, I had applied for journalism jobs in the States and didn't have any luck there, and so I just felt like, well, my best option at this point is just to go back independently and see if I can do it as a freelance writer.
You went from the southwest to the north. How did you pick Beijing for your second stay?
Well, if you're going to be a journalist in China, you live either in Beijing or Shanghai. I mean, actually, at that time, that was the law. I mean, if you were going to become registered as a journalist, you're in one of those two cities. And so all of the foreign news bureaus were in these cities. And I felt like I needed to be attached in some way to an organization. And so I wrote to various bureaus, and the Wall Street Journal gave me a part-time job. Sort of as an assistant in their bureau, and so that's why I chose Beijing.
And you did write a few newspaper articles and magazine articles, but I guess you say you decided you were not cut out to be a deadline journalist.
No, I mean, I actually wrote a lot that year for newspapers and magazines. I must have been probably doing my first 2 years in China, probably doing 60 or 70 stories a year. But it was always hard for me. My work patterns and the pacing and everything is much more suited to doing long-form magazine stories and books. And so I was very happy once that side of things opened up and I was able to move away from news and away from newspaper writing.
And when you finally lucked out and got the job as the Chinese correspondent for The New Yorker, you only had to write a few pieces a year.
It's totally up to me. I mean, that's one of the nice things about this sort of position is that I'm not committed to doing anything I don't want to do, and I basically choose my projects. And sometimes the editors there will have a suggestion or something they want, and we'll talk about it. And a few of my stories have come about through that, but mostly I choose what I want to work on, and I work on it at my own pace. Which for me is ideal. For some people, it might not be such a good system because you have to be self-motivated, and you have to sort of figure out your own schedule and your own pacing.
And your new book, Oracle Bones, which I enjoyed very much, I would say almost all the main characters and most of the main themes originally appeared in New Yorker articles.
A fair number, although quite a bit of it was also done in conjunction with National Geographic stories. But these, they were always in different forms. I mean, in the end, what you can do for a magazine is not what you can do for a book. And the magazine stories were always shortened to some degree or edited. As a writer, you never have complete control over them. And so that's the great thing about doing a book is you can sort of explore things more fully. You can make connections between projects you've been working on. That was really the goal with this book. I had been working on a number of stories for magazines, and I realized how they all connected up, and there were certain stories that I wanted to continue. And so I realized that the book was a perfect way to do it.
And I will say that although I enjoyed many of the articles when I read them in The New Yorker, they sometimes read like New Yorker articles. There's a certain style of going from the general to the personal and the past to the present, which sometimes gets to seem a bit formulaic, but in book form, it works almost ideally.
Yeah, I mean, I also didn't want this to be a collection of pieces, so these are not stories that appeared in The New Yorker and the National Geographic. I mean, I feel like here I was able to just sort of let them take their own narrative shape, each story I pursue in its own way, and they're woven together throughout the book. So, as a writer, this is the goal, I think, is to find a way to balance these different types of work. And I'm still still quite young as a writer. I feel like I'm still learning a lot, and so this has been a great experience for me.
The book covers roughly 3 years of your life as you move around and meet various people, especially the Uyghur Polot and several of your former students in Fuleng who you kept in touch with. And that's interspersed with chapters on the oracle bones, the ancient Chinese writing, and especially the life of some of the people who investigated them, one person in particular, Chen Mingjia. And it gives a very, very nice mix of the personal and the more or less objective. Did you have in mind when you started out that someone like Chen Mingjia would be that important?
No, I mean, you know, and actually his story was something that Chen Mingjia is a scholar, a famous poet and oracle bone scholar who was sort of hounded to suicide in the 1960s during the Cultural Revolution, and his story had been more or less neglected. I mean, it had never been written about in English and not very much in Chinese, and I just happened to stumble onto one of his books while I was researching something else and became interested in it and started asking questions, and then slowly was sort of drawn into the story and trying to figure out what happened to this man and you know, how I could track his life and the things that had moved him and inspired him. And, you know, it certainly, for me, it was a way to gain some historical perspective on China. This current generation, there was so much economic energy, and it becomes so much a story focused on the here and now. And once I began to talk to some of these older people who remember Chen Mingjia, you know, I realized that this generation is also very important, the people who are now in their 80s and 90s. And I think sometimes those of us who are living in China, writing about China, forget that.
In both books, but especially in Oracle Bones, well, I'd say actually in Rivertown, you're on your own a lot. You were a runner, a backpacker, and you would just go off into the mountains when you felt like it. And you also took part in Chinese races in a way that most foreigners would not do. How did you find, was it easy to integrate into Chinese life? Because it's not only the different culture, but also so many different legal standards and ideas of what's proper behavior.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it was very hard at the beginning. And, you know, when the Peace Corps, you just sort of dropped in there, and we were given 2 months of training about as good as you could possibly train with language and culture in 2 months. You know, did the best job we could with that, but that's not much time. And then we were dropped into these small places, and along with another young man, I was sent to a town called Fuleng, which had no other foreign residents and hadn't had any American residents for about half a century. And so it's very intense and very difficult. And I think the first year was quite hard. But it's sort of sink or swim. And maybe it was around 9 months or so where I could feel myself sort of turning a corner with regard to both the language and also just the comfort level in the town. And so you just become, you know, first of all, once you gain a handle on the language, everything gets a lot easier. And then there's just a lot of other sort of small, subtle things that you learn when you're in a situation like that. So I felt like I was fortunate because, you know, the learning curve was intense. I sort of had to pick up everything as quickly as possible. And by the end of a year, I started to feel quite comfortable. And at the end of 2 years, I felt like I could handle, you know, most situations. And really, since that Peace Corps experience, I've always felt quite comfortable in China. It is a difficult place. It can be, you know, it's a complicated language and a complicated culture, but at the same time, there is a certain openness and a certain informality. I think actually the Chinese are not so formal. It's not sort of like Japanese culture where there are lots of very strict rules. And the Chinese can actually be quite flexible, and they're certainly very pragmatic. And you know, I think that helps if you're an outsider moving into the culture.
But you never hesitated to just wander off into the mountains by yourself?
No, I've always been somebody who likes doing outdoors things. I'm experienced with that. And so that's a very comfortable milieu. And also in China, when you're in the mountains, you're not going to see very many people, you know, because in the areas where I was living, the Chinese were not doing hiking or camping. And so sometimes it was just a nice way to escape from, you know, from being in a city that's sort of teeming with people and you know, and energy. Sometimes it's very, you know, it's very important to get away. And actually in Beijing, for the past 4 or 5 years, I've kept a home in the countryside outside of Beijing in a very small, remote village for the same reason, sort of as an escape.
In Oracle Bones, there's several times when you either intentionally or unintentionally break the law. Unintentionally, I guess, by going to camp by the Great Wall at a time when and not taking your passport, and other times more deliberately just avoiding things you knew you were supposed to do, or even faking your documents.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel you're going to get in any trouble for any of this?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think they probably got bigger fish to fry. I mean, if they went and tracked down everybody who'd broken laws, especially with registration, they'd be even busier than they are. I mean, the truth is, this is the way people live in China now. It's a bureaucratic society, but it's one that's under tremendous transformation. And when you have that kind of situation, there are always a lot of rules and standards and formalities that are out of date. And so people have to find ways to get this paperwork done, even if it's pointless. And actually, some of these rules have changed. And I write in this book, Oracle Bones, about how I lived in a neighborhood that was not legal for journalists. And because of that, I always avoided registering. Well, last year, you know, they changed the law and I registered. So, you know, that was sort of after the book was written. But things are always in movement there. But it is a very weird environment. It's one of the things I wrote about because, you know, I describe my own sort of relationship with the law there, but also the relationship of the characters. Each of these main characters at some point does something that's basically illegal or in some sense wrong. And that's not the, you know, I see that not as a reflection so much of their character as a reflection of the environment that they're living in. This is, you know, something that I think is characteristic of this particular age in China.
Your colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Ian Johnson, wrote a book a couple of years ago, and I had an opportunity to talk to him, called Wild Grass, Three Stories of Change in Modern China, which emphasized three people who were going out and very deliberately breaking the law to bring about change. And his book seemed rather optimistic that these people, a lawyer who was fighting corruption in the countryside, people who were fighting the demolition of the old city of Beijing, and members of the Falun Gong, were all encountering extremely difficult circumstances, but things felt kind of hopeful. In your book, you cover some of the same people, and I don't feel... You're much more neutral. How do you feel about developments in China? Do you think...
Well, you know, I guess that... I mean, my interest so much is not whether there is a political change. And actually, the people that I'm writing about, there is one who has a strong political component. The others are more or less just concerned with improving their everyday lives. And I feel like in that seems to be what the energy of most average Chinese is being directed at this generation. I feel like that the individual Chinese tend to be focused on their own situations, improving their job prospects, you know, working to make things better for their families. I don't think it's still fairly uncommon to have this sort of broader political ambitions or the sense that the system needs to be changed. I mean, there are certainly people like this, and I thought Ian wrote about them beautifully in Wild Grass. But, I think he would agree that it still seems to be quite early in that process, and these are not priorities that are shared by the average Chinese. So I think it's going to take a while for that sort of energy, for the energy in China to be directed in such a fashion. So I've always felt like it's remarkable change. The transformation is remarkable, but it's not a political transformation. And it's very hard at this moment to predict when that would be. It just doesn't feel to me like it would be soon, though. I've never felt like the Communist Party is on the verge of falling.
But both South Korea and Taiwan experienced economic growth that led to pretty vigorous democracies. Singapore underwent economic growth, and there's been no democracy. What do you think is going to happen in the mainland?
It's so hard because they're such different places, you know, and each of them is its own story, and also each of them has a very different relationship to the outside world. I mean, often people look at Taiwan and say that, oh, this is the way China is going to go, but it's important to realize that Taiwan, you know, it was a very repressive state under the KMT for decades, no question about it. It was a police state. But throughout that period, they had very intense contact with the United States and with other Western nations. And so there were lots of Taiwanese who were going abroad, who were having contact with the outside world. And I think that helped them make this change much, you know, fairly quickly and certainly, you know, relatively painlessly. The mainland's a different situation. I mean, I think the problem is that in the mainland you had a police state, a repressive state, a totalitarian government. But it was also combined with a period of very little contact with the outside world throughout the Mao years. You know, very basically the Soviet Union, and even that was a very troubled relationship. And so, you know, I think that's a disadvantage for China's transformation. And, of course, the other issue is simply size. I mean, the place is so massive. And, you know, with 1.3 billion people, there's no comparison with what you have in South Korea or Taiwan or any of these other countries. And so I think that's one of the things that's a little bit intimidating about China. There is no blueprint for this transformation. I guess the other reference point could be the Soviet Union, but that change is one that happened very quickly. And I think we've sort of seen that it might not have worked out for the best. It might have been better if things had moved slower there. It's very hard. I mean, this is the first time anybody's made these sort of transitions from communist societies. And one thing that I realized living there is that the psychological component is the key. You know, you sort of have to give people some time to adjust to things. And I feel like the Chinese are adjusting to a new economic climate, but I always sense among them that they do not want to adjust yet to a radically different political environment.
And I guess the response to Falun Gong is indicative of that, that if any organization seems to get too strong in a way that the government doesn't like, they will crack down very quickly.
Certainly. And I think the other thing that's important to notice with that is that the average Chinese was not particularly sympathetic. You know, I mean, this was a situation that I think, really, when you looked at it, this group was not a serious threat. And you know, you might not agree with what they're doing, and you might have no interest in it, but, it certainly doesn't seem to harm anybody to have people practicing some kind of exercise routine that has a meditative component. But the average Chinese, was not sympathetic to their plight. Many people I talk to feel like the Falun Gong sort of stirred up trouble by protesting what the government was doing. And so, it's another step that needs to be taken, I think, towards a civil society. You have to reach the point where people can kind of put themselves in somebody else's shoes and say, well, I'm not that person. I don't necessarily believe what he believes, but I can understand where he's coming from. And I think that's still quite rare in China.
Is the country unifying, do you think? I know that you emphasize in Oracle Bones the linguistic differences between the North and South in particular, and the fact that even with a written language, Cantonese uses a somewhat different grammatical structure than Mandarin, and that having Mandarin imposed as the national language has unified the country to some degree, but there are still many people who don't function with it. Do you think there's any chance that China might fall apart, I guess is what I'm coming to?
I think that, it is a remarkably diverse place, and you sort of feel these provincial divisions more and more now, partly because government is becoming localized, and also because people are moving because of the migration. So they come more in contact with prejudices that somebody might have from people from Sichuan province or from Guizhou province or wherever they may come from. Having said that, I think the patriotism in China is really quite intense, and it's not simply something that the government has created. I think the average Chinese feels a strong connection to their country and feels a strong sense of unity. Unity is important to them. So, my general feeling is that it would be, it would be unlikely. And for example, any sort of Chinese leader who said, okay, we're going to let Xinjiang become an independent country, or we're going to let Tibet become an independent country, I think he would be just absolutely vilified.
And probably the same with Taiwan.
Certainly. I mean, that's a particularly complicated relationship. I mean, and if you talk to an average Chinese person, they will believe wholeheartedly that everybody in Taiwan wants to return to China. It's just their leaders that won't let them. And this is sort of, there are some very basic misconceptions about what life is like in Taiwan and what the Taiwanese believe and what their, what their priorities may be. But at the same time, there are these sort of incredibly close economic links between these two places. And in the end, after all, sort of the threats and the political side of things, it might be the economic issue that becomes more important there. They might be able to figure out some sort of solution based on that, because there's just a massive amount of Taiwanese investment right now in the mainland.
Yeah, I would think something sort of like the special arrangement with Hong Kong.
Yeah, it's different, though, because, you know, Taiwan at this point has already, you know, they are having very democratic elections, and Hong Kong never had that. You know, Hong Kong was a colony, and it was sort of given from one, basically from the British to the Chinese, and the people never really had any say in it, and that's a very different situation. Once people begin voting and begin choosing their leaders, I think it's hard for one of those leaders to make a decision and say, okay, we're going to return to China. I mean, my gut instinct would be with Taiwan that if Taiwan was going to make some sort of political shift of that nature, it would only happen after there is a significant political change in the mainland, and that becomes more appealing to the people in Taiwan. Because I don't see how, with a democratic system, you know, a leader can simply make that decision. It would have to be agreed upon by the Taiwanese people, I feel like. That's just a practical point. They're simply accustomed to voting at this point.
That was a conversation I recorded recently with Peter Hessler, the New Yorker's correspondent in China, and author most recently of Oracle Bones, A Journey Between China's Past and Present, which has just been published by HarperCollins. This has been the first online, purely online, not radio version of Booktown, which is also available through KVMR-FM in Nevada City, California. You can reach this and all other recorded versions of Booktown, both online and on air, by going to kvmr.org and finding the Booktown listing in the program schedule, or you can go to booktown.blogspot.com.